once again, Colonel Vindman, every single day between now and the election, we need to remember Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We missed him last week, but we have him now. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quam Report. He is known as the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And as Texas goes, so goes the nation. It seems like 2 years, but it has only been 2 weeks. So I missed you on Super Tuesday, missed you on sort of little Super Tuesday, and now we're into facing a COVID-19 pandemic, oil and gas is in the toilet, and there will be a debate on Sunday night between Biden and Bernie, the only two left standing after we started out with the most diverse field and 24 people.
How do you feel about that, Arnie? All the diversity is gone. Now it's just old white men who I think you said for – did you say this for both of them, that they should not have run?
Yes.
I know you said that for Bernie.
I said that for both of them. And, in fact, I just did a show this morning.
Are you upset now?
I'm furious. So I did a show this morning in Tampa, and one of the things I said was I had begged them a year and a half ago not to run. I said, and I got such negative feedback. You won't even believe it.
Well, they hate that.
I know. But one of the things I said this morning was, I said, you know, I ran for office and people have begged me to run again and run again. And here's the line I use, and it's the line that I wish Bernie and Biden realized. And that is, some of us get to open doors and others get to walk through them. Biden and Bernie have opened doors. They clearly have. I mean, Bernie can see it in 2018. He can see it in AOC. He can see it in the squad. He can see it in a whole conga line of issues that he actually brought forward. Biden has been doing this. This is his third run. He was the vice president with Barack Obama. There was no calling for Biden. There was calling for change because of Trump. But these two men, it's so about them as much as they think it is about us. And I'm disappointed. I'm just disappointed.
You know, I'm not sure I agree with that, but I know your disappointment runs deep, so I'll go gently here. You know, when it comes to Sanders, I fully agree. It does seem to be all about him, and here's why I say it, because the kind of coalition that he's been trying to put together, and I wrote about this at CNN.com. They were nice enough to publish me this past couple weeks. He has not proven that he can put together this group of, you know, the young and the old and the, you know, folks across different ethnic groups and all of that. The coalition for Bernie, it's just not there. His base is kind of what it was 4 years ago. In fact, in some of the key groups, when you look at the different polling numbers and you look at some of the different election results, he's actually gone down with some of the groups from 4 years ago. With Biden, it's a different question. So we got four states deep before his voters started to show up. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You had Iowa, New Hampshire, where you are, in Nevada, and then you get to South Carolina. And he was depending on who? On the African-Americans who were, you know, a big part of the Obama coalition, you know, back in 2008 and 2012. And they have shown up, Arnie, in numbers that are similar to what they,
Obama,
you know, performed for Obama. Mm-hmm. It's just breathtaking, actually. And someone was saying just yesterday, you know, just wait till Obama and Biden start campaigning together, which of course is probably what's going to happen at some point. With Biden, I thought his speech on Mini Super Tuesday, is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, I think that's what
when it was pretty clear that he was winning all across these mini Super Tuesday states, It was sober. It was the kind of thing that's the exact contrast that's needed with President Trump,
absolutely,
who could barely get through his teleprompter speech from the White House coronavirus, COVID-19.
Right. Yeah.
If people want a choice between the chaotic and the steady, that's what they need to see. Although that was only one performance, and Biden hasn't always been as steady as that. But it has been just fascinating to watch. After Super Tuesday. And really after South Carolina, leading into Super Tuesday.
Let me just remind you,
watch the rest of the Democratic Party get in formation, which is exactly what the Republicans did not do with Donald Trump when he was seeking the nomination.
And I actually thought that Bernie's speech was also getting in formation, believe it or not. And while
he was
acknowledging that Biden was the nominee, because he didn't say he basically said, "What will you do?" It was like, "What will you do?" In the sense that you are going to be the president. So here are my questions to you. It wasn't like I am better than you, or you can't answer these questions, or I'm the only one who can deliver the answer. He was really, in a lot of ways, it was the student and the teacher. I have a question for you, professor. I have a question for you. But obviously the role of professor is the role of leader. And I really do value, I think, what can happen on Sunday night in a negative way, but in a positive way as we move forward. And I will tell you that Biden's speech was beautiful. There were tears rolling down my cheeks. He does empathy and compassion and stability in a way that we so yearn that. But what we are clearly seeing with COVID-19 is something that Bernie has been speaking about forever, and Elizabeth Warren, and that is the vulnerability of the American worker. And it's not just the vulnerability with health care. It's the vulnerability with their lack of, a livable wage, their vulnerability with the lack of days off from being ill, the lack of vulnerability from unemployment compensation that doesn't even come close to compensating you. All those things about workplace justice, especially Bernie has been talking about, all those things are going to undermine our economy over the course of the next year because we never prepared for it. Nancy Pelosi is coming in with a bill to try to fill a lot of those holes, but that's kind of not enough and maybe a little late, but that doesn't mean that we can't address it going forward.
We'll see what the lasting impact of this coronavirus pandemic, which, of course, the World Health Organization just this week officially declared it a pandemic, and then you saw the Dow drop another 1,400 points, something like that. And it is a real test of the U.S. healthcare system, as you said. Somebody said it this way yesterday, Arnie. We're about to see just how under-hospitalized we are in the United States. We just don't have enough beds. We don't have enough capacity. For all of the folks who could fall ill, and that's why you see major events, some of them right here in Texas, that were canceled. Just this past week, I was with some friends on Friday, right after I would have talked to you if we'd have been on the air, and the word came down that South by Southwest in Austin had been canceled, which is an international event. It's a $300 million injection into the local economy in the city. You had the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, which is the largest event of its kind on Earth, which was canceled just yesterday as we tape here on Thursday. It was canceled on Wednesday. Tens of thousands of people who would have otherwise been, getting together to have a great time in Houston, same thing in Austin, not doing that now because of the fear of community spread with coronavirus. And it's a shifting situation where we had thought that only those who had done some international travel, some people who had been on cruises, et cetera, would have been those who would have been the risk of spreading to others. But we did in Houston have at least one case that we know of where someone had gone to the barbecue cook-off at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, somebody from Montgomery County, which is north of Houston. This person had not traveled internationally, so we had evidence of community spread. So now there's more fear that this is going to be moving a lot more quickly, and the World Health Organization putting out their guidance on this. In the meantime, there are states all around the country declaring states of emergency.
Right.
We have not seen that in Texas. I was looking through exactly what it would take and what would happen if the state of Texas was to join them. There are a lot of different things that state government can do to step in. Right now, it's the local governments that are on the front line, if you will, of dealing with this. Those in Harris County, Travis County, et cetera, where we have seen cases of coronavirus, be very clear about this, we have seen just a few cases that have been confirmed of this disease. We haven't seen a ton of this, but you know, multiple cases confirmed in this state. So you know, government moving you know, sort of quickly at the local level, more slowly at the state level. And then, of course, we saw what President Trump had to say at the federal level.
So let me just say something. I've been saying a lot about the undocumented immigrants and what are they going to do to access the kind of health care they're going to need, the kind of testing they're going to need, who's going to pay for this testing. I'm also going to talk about something else that Donald Trump has done, which will impact Texas and many other states, and that is the public charge rule, which will make people who are, you know, trying to obtain citizenship or green cards frightened of being able to access Medicaid or any of the public services, even though they're here legally. Legally, they're working, but like you, they might lose their job, which means they may need benefits. They may need Medicaid to go to a doctor. They may need food stamps to feed their family. But because of the reinstatement of the public charge rule, they're going to be afraid to access that because it might mean they never become a citizen. They never get that green card. Of all the times, someone described Donald Trump, he's our Captain Queeg. Of all the times to have him be in charge and his assault on immigration, whether it's legal or undocumented, it's also going to put us to a real test with this COVID-19 pandemic because it's really important that everyone get tested. And I don't care what their status is. You are here, you get tested. You need help, you get that help. Otherwise, all of us are vulnerable.
Yeah, it's when you cry wolf all the time about the immigrant population.
Exactly.
It makes it more difficult to deal with when something's actually happening that you need to have a targeted approach about who might be, you know, a risk of carrying this disease. And so that's really muddied the water.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about what is happening with the oil and gas industry. Obviously, the first place that comes to my mind is Houston, Texas. Saw an article the other day that given what's happening, there's a potential loss of 20 to 22,000 jobs, which in a place the size of Houston doesn't sound like a lot. But when you also realize they're the most well compensated of any of the employees and that's just within the industry, imagine the ripple effect as a result of that.
There are more than 400,000 people in the Houston area who work directly in the oil and gas industry, Arnie, and these are mostly folks who are well compensated. We talk about Houston as the energy capital of the world. Now, that does not mean that in Texas we extract the most hydrocarbons from the ground, but we do have the best minds on planet Earth for how to get that done, whether it comes to fracking or other ways of extracting oil and gas. This is something that affects Republicans and Democrats alike. You know, I was at a birthday party for a friend who's a Democrat in North Houston, and you know, we were some friends were heading to this party, and they said, "Well, we're going to the Mexican part of town." I said, "Well, it's the oil and gas Mexican part of town, because right around that area, right up the street, is, you know, Halliburton, Baker Hughes, you name it, all these oil field services companies." And those folks work at those places, and whether they're Republicans or Democrats, all that money spends the same, right? We now have oil, as we talk here on Thursday, oil is at 30 a barrel. The comptroller for the state of Texas, one of the things that's very difficult, a job that this person has to do, the accountant for the state of Texas, the comptroller, is supposed to try to figure out what tax revenue is going to be over a 24-month horizon, Arnie, when they write the state budget, because our legislature only meets once every 2 years in regular session, they have to write that budget over a two-year period. And so the comptroller has to be able to tell lawmakers how much money they're going to have to work with over that period of time. I like to say it this way. Writing the budget for the state of Texas versus you writing the budget for your household is like landing on the moon versus you parking in your driveway. They're nothing alike. And so when the comptroller is trying to figure out how much money we're going to have available, one key thing that they look at is the price of a barrel of oil, because economists will tell you there's no single better indicator of the overall health of the economy of this state than price per barrel of oil. And the comptroller had estimated that in 2020, this year, the average price of a barrel of oil would be around $50. And in 2021, that the average price, I think he had said it would be around $53 a barrel. Now, that could still be true if the oil prices go back up. We don't know. Here's something that we do have to keep in mind here. The oil price went down, right, because Saudi Arabia and Russia are in an all-out price war. That the Saudis, you know, are trying to bring Russia to the table by flooding the market with oil and selling it cheaply as they can. because they are able to extract oil from the ground easier than we are able to do here. In Saudi Arabia, it's all sand, and it basically just bubbles up out of the ground. It's very cheap for them to take oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia.
Uh-huh.
In Texas and in the shale play areas like Pennsylvania, et cetera, uh-huh. oil and gas, you have to break through rock to get to it, and that's why we use hydraulic fracturing, fracking for short.
Uh-huh.
And it's more expensive to do it that way here. So I was talking to some folks who understand the geopolitics of all this better than I do, and it may be a bluff on the part of the Saudis to put oil at $25 or $30 a barrel. They have had, and you may have read about this, they have had a sort of back and forth in their country about how much in the way of public benefits to have for people, for the average citizen in Saudi Arabia,
right, right.
versus austerity measures. They've gone back and forth on that for several years now, going back to at least 2014, 2015, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks who know Saudi Arabia well will tell you that to try to keep the people in Saudi Arabia, somewhat happy to the point where they're not revolting against the royal family, they really need oil to be at about the same price that the state of Texas does, which is about $50 to $55 a barrel. All that to say that they may be bluffing here, that the prices may stabilize once again, but in the meantime, state leadership really has to grapple, and people in Houston as well, specifically, have to grapple with how we pay for things going forward if this is a protracted battle, because they can keep the prices cheaper than certainly we can afford in Texas. We pay for public schools, we pay for transportation, we pay for all sorts of things in this state based off of that, based off of the oil and gas severance taxes. And we also have what we call the Economic Stabilization Fund in Texas. You may have heard of our Rainy Day Fund here.
Yep.
Which some other states have as well. Other energy states also do this. And one of the reasons that they originally set up the Economic Stabilization Fund, which is funded through oil and gas taxes, Arnie, is because the legislators at the time, Republicans and Democrats years ago, they realized this. You look at the pattern, and it's just self-evident, right, that when the economy goes south, the demand for government services goes north, right?
Mm-hmm.
More people need help when the economy gets bad. So when the oil prices are good, like they were going back even to 2013, and oil prices were around $100 a barrel, that meant that that fund was being replenished faster. So you had billions of dollars going into that Economic Stabilization Fund. There are conservatives who argue that you should almost never, ever spend that fund. At one point we had around $10 billion in that fund, and how were we going to spend it? Some of that money was drawn down in the last legislative session to pay for public education and to pay for property tax relief here in Texas, and we also had the fact that we had just had a hurricane, which you remember, Hurricane Harvey,
of course.
In the Houston area. And so there will be this back and forth about whether to spend that money. Some women at the Capitol, Arnie, like to joke that the Economic Stabilization Fund, with all the billions of dollars that are in there, must be run by men because they just like to brag about how big it is but don't know how to use it. And so here you have, you'll get that in a second, but the fact of the matter is that when there is this push and pull, it's not just a deal where they have a savings account and it's only supposed to be used very, 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 very sparingly.
Right.
No, the whole idea was that you would have this pot of money to be able to smooth out government revenues.
Yeah.
When the economy is bad, so that they don't have to raise taxes in other areas, and we'll see exactly what the decision is. How to respond to some of these things, given the vast resources that we do have.
So let me just make a comment that one of the things I've also heard about why Saudi Arabia is doing that is that they know that the fracking industry is highly leveraged, and that it's going to be consumed with debt. And then because as you pointed out, it's so much more expensive for them to extract oil. As a result, what they are hoping is that this is their way of basically sort of completely destroying fracking as a potential for retrieving these kind of natural resources.
Sure.
And it really is a way. I mean, they are offended that we are producing so much oil and gas. They are offended because it is now competition in a way they haven't seen. But given all the things that they're looking at, including, frankly, let's be honest, COVID-19, that just means that fewer and fewer people are going to be traveling. There's going to be less and less need for oil and gas. That means the market itself is going to be overloaded because there isn't going to be the same drain. We see that in China. We're going to see that in the United States. And what Saudi Arabia is doing is kind of like we're like the icing on the cake. This will break the back of fracking. And that's really what they're hoping. So it's going to be interesting. You're absolutely right that they need to stabilize their economy because they keep writing big checks to everyone that lives in Saudi Arabia because
right.
they had all this extra quote-unquote cash. Now, obviously, that'll be depleted, but they probably are trying to sort of do a cost-benefit analysis.
Yes, and in the meantime, in Houston, there was a story in Houston Chronicle this morning that oil companies were moving really quickly over the last just few days, trying to do a few things of, slashing their spending and their dividends,
right.
trying to stabilize their bottom lines. We had seen Occidental Petroleum, Marathon Oil, they each cut about a third of their planned capital spending, so their capital outlays are smaller now, cutting about $1.7 billion just this week from Occidental, $500 million from Marathon. And they're trying to do all they can to not lay folks off. Those are the first
right.
things that they cut are some of the capital outlays and things like that. But, of course, they also have what they would say is a responsibility to their shareholders, so there will be some people who are laid off. And, Arnie, we had already seen some signs of stress in the oil patch in Texas, and this is a pivotal moment, for the state's economy and
yeah.
perhaps a wake-up call that we do have to continue to try to diversify our economy.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You have diversified your economy significantly.
That's right.
I mean, so while this is still a huge and important revenue source, mm-hmm. there has been a sense that they needed to sort of level it out and diversify. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as you point out, this is not maybe going to point out that not enough.
Well, perhaps not enough. And, myself, others have, for a long time, Republicans and Democrats have talked about the need to have an all-of-the-above approach to
mm-hmm.
energy, particularly in Texas, where we do have access to other types of power, wind power, solar, hydro, et cetera. All of that needs to be.
Whatever package comes out of Washington, and please don't be offended by this, I want the package to be focused on workers and not on the industry. I think this is also a way for the industry to have a come-to-Jesus moment. You mentioned about all of the above. This is a way for them to figure out how to diversify into alternatives. You see, I see what's happening as a horrific thing for workers. I don't see this as necessarily a horrific thing for climate. What they said in China, for example, was because of COVID-19, because of what happened, they had the cleanest air they'd had in decades because they were not consuming as much oil, coal, and gas. And so that's a positive if you're looking at climate change and you're looking at the ability to have a healthy environment. It is a negative in the sense of what are you making? Probably less of things, but we need to figure out how to make things without depending on something that also kills us. So it's going to be it's such a fine line between good and evil. So talk to me about your governor. One of the things I found really interesting is that a lot of the Democratic governors seem to be willing to sort of talk about the crisis, or seem willing to be moving forward, or willing to shut down schools, institute some really sort of significant and severe changes in their state and in local communities. How's Governor Abbott doing? I haven't heard much from Mike Chris Sununu. I haven't heard much from a lot of the Republican governors, and I don't want this to be a Republican-Democratic response. This is a health care crisis.
It seems that it has been a Democratic and Republican
yes.
thing, though, isn't it?
Yes.
He had the governor yesterday. He had a conference call with mayors and county judges, which, of course, he's been at war with them over local control and how to deal with various issues, including property taxes. In particular, he was asked if he was going to declare a state of emergency about coronavirus. His office said to stay tuned about that. As I mentioned earlier, when states of emergency are declared in these different states, Arnie, that means different things for each state as far as what their state governments actually are going to do. But it is interesting that the Republican governors, including Abbott, have been muted.
It's
this.
Absolutely shocking.
They don't want to get out ahead of the president because, look, you have the president delivering a bunch of mixed messages about this, saying things that are flatly untrue
right.
About the situation, which is it's the worst thing that you could have going on whenever there is a legitimate public health crisis. As a friend said yesterday, it's all fun and games with Trump until there's a real situation. This isn't some
right.
white paper at a conservative think tank. This is actually, a disease that may be spreading and could kill people across the United States. What are the feds doing? What is the state doing? There are various things. Right now, you do have the local governments, as I mentioned earlier, taking the lead on this.
Yes.
And we have seen in recent years a pattern develop. I'll say it this way. The government in Texas, the government at the state capitol, has been at war with the local governments over local control, property taxes, and a few few other things, local regulations, et cetera. But whenever there's a crisis, the state kind of defers to the local governments on that, you know, expects that they're going to jump in. And we do have, you know, I was listening to the comments from Angela Merkel in Germany,
right,
where they were talking about how, you know, a lot of the response to this is localized and is therefore tailored to those local communities.
Mm-hmm.
In Texas, we're sort of like a small country here. We're, you know, it's,
yep,
30 million people here. We have 254 counties across two time zones. And, you know, when the conservative think tankers, if you will, when they start talking about this stuff, they say, well, you know, the local governments are a political subdivision of the state of Texas, you know, under our Constitution, which is correct, and
right,
so that they're subservient somehow to the state government. But the answer to that, of course, is that the reason you have political subdivisions in a state that is this large, is because you have to have individualized, you know, responses to different things. However, in a situation like this, it would be appropriate for the governor to show leadership.
Right.
I would put a little finer point on it, which is to say this. In 2017, the governor of Texas called a special session of the Texas legislature to try to talk about and debate who should be able to use which bathroom.
Right.
And yet on this, I haven't heard much from him.
All right, and I need to let you go, but I also remind everyone that the state with the highest level of uninsured is the state of Texas. Governor, how are you going to step up to that? That alone, you didn't expand Medicaid. You have the highest percentage of uninsured. You have a tremendous number of undocumented immigrants on top of all this. This is a challenge for Texas. You can't just solve it county by county. You can't just solve it community by community. You need leadership out of Austin. And on that note, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report, joins us every Friday. Thank you so much. I've missed you.
Thanks, Arnie. Love you. Talk soon.
All right. Talk soon. Stick around, everyone. We're going to be talking a little bit more about oil and gas, and we're talking about the carbon dividend. We'll be right back.
Using gravity to predict floods. It's a weighty topic on This Current Cast. NASA satellites monitor changes in the Earth's gravity field. Yes, gravity changes. J.T. Rager of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory says shifting water masses play a role.
If you have more water in a region, you have more mass there. And more mass is associated with more gravity, and therefore changes in water can cause changes in gravity.
So think of river basins as buckets. When they're almost full of snow, soil moisture, and groundwater, the NASA satellites will measure a small increase in gravity, alerting us that the system is saturated and more likely to flood with added precipitation. Rager says that by combining gravity measurements with weather forecasts, we could see floods coming about 5 months in advance. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Pieces. I listen out for beating heart.
hearts. Now it's time for healing. The sun will rise, but this time it's so bright. And all I have left is my faith that we could change. Cause I can't watch us lose. I can't watch us lose what we found. You'd have thought we'd learned, you'd have thought we'd learned by now. I can hear the whole world singing together. I can hear the whole world say it's now or never. Cause it's not.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So I'm looking at a couple of things from yesterday. Plunge in oil price prompts swift response. And then I'm looking at an article from the American Prospect from December 5th of 2019, Carbon Dividends and the Green New Deal. There's a new book out called The Case for Carbon Dividends, and there is a recent article in a tax journal about carbon dividends. Why am I talking about this? Because James K. Boyce is a senior fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And as I just mentioned, he is also the author of that new book, The Case for Carbon Dividends. So let me welcome James to the program, and also to say to you, James, I just feel like everything is swirling around simultaneously. What does the plunge in oil and gas mean? Are they going to break the back of fracking? How are we going to respond as a nation? Is this a good thing when we're talking carbon dividends? Obviously, the Green New Deal was front and center when you were talking about Biden versus Bernie, the only two left standing out of the 24 conga line of candidates we had at the very beginning of this presidential campaign. So I'm going to welcome you to the program and sort of ask you maybe in order of events, as we're looking at what Saudi Arabia and Russia are doing with oil and gas, is this something that we need to sort of factor in as we talk about the carbon dividend? Or is the carbon dividend sort of in an island unto itself? Is it something that is both useful for getting us off the oil and gas teat? And is it also a way for us to begin to understand why a Green New Deal, sustainability, is a solution for what is going to ail us economically as well as from an environmental perspective? So with all those ridiculous questions on my plate, you can begin anywhere. But I'm a little curious about what Saudi Arabia and Russia are doing, since you focus so much on the whole industry itself. But I know you're looking at the dividend. I am looking at also what does it mean for the arguments you're going to be making going forward.
Well, thanks, Arnie, and thanks for having me on the show. You're right. There's an awful lot going on around the world right now, and a lot of it does have impacts for climate change and for what we need to do in terms of climate policy.
Yeah.
First, about the current plunge in oil prices. On the whole, I don't think that's good news for climate policy or climate change, and the reason's pretty simple. If the prices are going down because supply is going up, which is what's happened with Russia and Saudi Arabia both opening the spigot and battling for market share, while it's true that those falling prices might drive some high-cost producers of oil out of the market, and that includes some of the hydrofracking production here in the U.S., the overall picture is that what's happening is supplies are going up, prices are going down, and that's making it more attractive for businesses and consumers as well to use more oil and use more fossil fuel and emit more carbon. So that's not good news. Now, at the same time, another thing that may be impacting the oil markets is, of course, the economic slowdown attributable to the coronavirus and all of the fear that that has engendered and the economic repercussions of things shutting down in so many places. That's falling demand. And that can also bring down prices. And when falling demand brings down prices, that's not a bad thing from the standpoint of climate change, because what it means is that people don't want to burn as much fossil fuels. But the cause of that fall in demand, a worldwide pandemic, is not exactly good news either. So in neither sense would I say that the fall in oil prices is something that we ought to be particularly happy about.
Well, and let me just
point of climate change.
Right, no. And I know that. And I wanted to sort of frame it because we're in this swirling bit of information happening everywhere. And it turns out it's interesting. We are focusing on the pandemic, but yet what am I hearing out of this president? We need to prop up the fracking industry. Can we write a bill to support oil and gas? And I'm thinking, that's not what I want to do with my revenue dollars.
As well.
Exactly.
That's sort of clinging on to the past. We need to be thinking about how to move into the future.
And you are absolutely right, because I mentioned this. We were talking with a fellow from Texas just before you, so understand this is front and center of my brain. And as I mentioned to him, that one of the things we realized in China, as a result of the beginning of the in that case, it was not a pandemic yet; it was basically focused on Wuhan, but all of China began to clamp down. Was that they saw the cleanest air quality they'd ever seen in China in decades? Because as you just point out, the COVID-19 has slowed down people's demand for oil, gas, coal, all those things. And while that's a negative for the economy, it actually was a positive for the environment and for people to be able to go, wow, I can breathe in Shanghai. Wow, I can breathe in Beijing.
Yeah,
and that just sort of shows.
It's ironic, isn't it, Arnie?
It is.
I mean, that actually brings out another important piece of the puzzle, which is that, the cutting down on our use of fossil fuels, freeing ourselves from fossil fuels, is not only a good thing for the planet and for future generations, but it's also a good thing for people here and now.
Right.
And one of the ways it's a good thing is that it helps us clean up the air.
Yes.
Just last week, a study came out that concluded that overall pollution from fossil fuels reduces life expectancy, average life expectancy worldwide by a year. It kills over a million people a year. Now, 4,000 people have died of coronavirus, and people are in a panic about that. And I'm not saying that there aren't good reasons to be deeply concerned about the coronavirus, but we also ought to be deeply concerned about the fact that a million people a year are getting killed by this kind of outdated practice, really, of digging up poisonous stuff from under the crust of the earth and burning it in order to meet our energy needs at a time when we've got really great clean energy options coming online. In Texas, for example, you've got a lot of wind power.
Right.
And that's the direction we ought to be going. We shouldn't be trying to prop up that industry of the past. We should be talking about trying to build the industries of the future.
And let's also talk about
one way to do that is to say that we're going to put a hard limit on the amount of fossil fuels that we allow into our economy.
Right.
And the reason that that's been a difficult lift for politicians and policymakers is that if you put a limit on the supply of fossil fuels, all else equal, their price is going to go up. I mean, that's what happens when OPEC cuts back the supply of oil. The price goes up. And if the United States were to say, we're going to cut the amount of fossil fuels we allow to enter our economy by 6% a year or 8% a year, whatever it is, with the goal of driving forward the clean energy transition, then the chances are really good that that's going to raise their prices. And if that happens, it's potentially going to produce a lot of backlash from consumers, as we saw in France last year when Macron, the president, proposed a fairly modest increase in fuel taxes. It provoked the Yellow Vest movement, which, as you know, swept through the country, turned violent, caused the government to back down. And that kind of brings home the fact that, you know, as the protesters in France said, Macron worries about the end of the world, but we worry about the end of the month. And really, you know, there are a lot of people who worry about the end of the month and have good reason to do so. And so what I think we need to design is a policy that manages to, on the one hand, put a hard limit on the amount of fossil fuels we let into the economy, drive down that limit over time to complete the clean energy transition, and at the same time, make sure that doing this doesn't put another burden on working families across the country. And the way to do that is to capture the money that consumers and businesses pay in higher fossil fuel prices and recycle it directly back into people's pockets in the form of carbon dividends. So that's what my book's about.
I know that's
what the case for carbon dividends is about.
And so what I want to do is I want to unpack this, because again, what we know is there are good ways of doing a carbon tax and there are bad ways of doing a carbon tax. Macron embraced the bad way, and the bad way, we saw the consequences of that. He had to back off of it, and it was because he did not reinvest those carbon dividends, especially in the people that were going to be so harmed as a result. I mean, they're already living vulnerably at the edge of a paycheck, and then to see the price of their diesel go through the roof when they were already paying incredibly high prices for their diesel. And a lot of these people live in remote areas of France where there isn't public transportation, there isn't an alternative. So they end up, you know, basically bearing the brunt of all this, where everybody else would be given options. They had few options. So we know that Macron's example is a bad example. You talk about the carbon dividends and the Green New Deal. You talk about carbon dividends and how we should sort of give it back. In a lot of ways, you sound a little bit like Andrew Yang, because it sounds a little bit almost like a universal basic income, but what's applying the income for the basic income turns out to be the carbon tax. So tell me how you would devise the dividend and why you argue, which I think doesn't make sense to me, but you can persuade me, why you argue that everybody should get the same amount of carbon dividend. Tax it, make sure that you make it more expensive so people will start looking at alternatives. But then with that money, you want to send the multimillionaire the same size check as the guy that's working at McDonald's. Why is that a good idea?
Okay, so that's a great question, Artie, and that gets to the universality dimension. And I think a good way to start thinking about that question is to ask the following. You know, why is it that Social Security is still around, still with us, after having been passed during the Depression in the 1930s and didn't get rolled back or eliminated despite the various political changes that have happened over the subsequent decades? Why do we still have Medicare after that was instituted back in the 60s? Why didn't that get abolished? What made these programs so politically popular, so durable, that regardless of who controlled the White House, regardless of who controlled the legislature, they endured, right? Mm-hmm. And my view is that one of the key reasons these were so popular is that they were universal. They didn't try to pick the virtuous or the deserving and deny the Social Security benefits or health care to the people who were less deserving. They made it universal. And I think that universality helps to account for the political appeal of these programs. And I think the same issue arises in the case of carbon dividends.
Okay.
Because we're not talking here about a policy that if you pass it, you know, in 2021, if political stars align and we implement such a policy, that you've solved the climate change. No, this policy has to stay in place
for
the several decades that will be needed to complete the clean energy transition. And so it has to be durable enough to survive no matter what party is controlling Congress. There's also a philosophical answer. Let me add that one, too, because this, I think, is a really important idea to think about and try to get across, which is that what we're talking about here is pushing for use of a scarce resource that is a gift of nature, that in that sense
yes.
is the common and equal property of everyone. And that's the scarce, limited carbon absorptive capacity, the biosphere. What we've been doing in the past is letting polluters dump their pollution into the atmosphere for free. And we want to limit that use of the atmosphere. And by limiting that use, it's going to raise prices to consumers, and we want to recycle the money that comes from charging for the use of the atmosphere back to the people. Now, who owns the atmosphere? And I think at the moment, of course, the problem is nobody really owns it, and anybody can use it and abuse it for free. But I think that a reasonable answer to that question is that we all own it. We own it in equal and common measure. And so carbon dividends are an example of what I sometimes call universal property. It's property that belongs to everyone as a birthright. Hmm. It's different from private property in that it can't be bought and sold. You can't sell your right to get a dividend. It
right.
can't be owned by corporations.
Right.
It can't be concentrated in a few hands. It's not private property, but it's also different from public property in the sense that we usually use the term. When people talk about public property, what they're really talking about is state property or government property.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean the money going to the government.
Right.
But what I'm talking about is property that really belongs to individuals. It's individual, it's inalienable, it can't be bought or sold, and it can't be transferred to someone else, and it's perfectly egalitarian. And being perfectly egalitarian means, yes, everybody gets a dividend, you know? Now, you have to, you know, if you get a dividend in Alaska, for example, from
we were just talking about this, yes.
You have to bother to fill out a one-page or two-page PDF or form in order to register for your dividend. My guess is that the Bill Gateses of the world, they might not bother to fill out the form because it's not worth 2 minutes of their time to get a few hundred dollars a month or a quarter as a dividend.
Right.
But, you know, for most people, it's going to be worth their time. They're going to do it, and it's going to be
helpful. I love you.
Helping to sustain their income.
So James, we should do a two-part series together, because I've talked about when they talk about free education, okay, free higher ed. You know, the idea that public schools would be free, technical schools would be free, two-year community college would be free. Oh, you mean we're going to give free stuff to those rich people? I'm going, no, those rich people are still going to go to the private colleges. They're still going to go to prep schools. They're still going to come on, honey bun. This free isn't going to be exercised by the very wealthy or the top 10%, frankly, because they're going to buy what they want because they know what they want. For those that want a higher education, the idea of not costing anything is the difference between saying yes and saying no, completing it in 4 years or never completing it, or dropping out and knowing that you'll not be indebted for life because life dumped on you because of the nature of life itself. So the idea of giving everyone the dividend, or the idea of giving everyone access to higher education, the wealthy still will choose to do what they always do, live in their gated communities, go to their private schools, go to their prep schools. They don't give a crap. What they will, however, do is help by helping to pay for it, so all of us have the same choice, whether you exercise it or not.
I agree, Arnie. It's
brilliant.
Is common sense. And, you know, it's important to realize, of course, that the rich people, in general, consume a hell of a lot more fossil fuel, a hell of a lot more carbon, both directly in terms of, you know, flying around in airplanes and all the fuel that that costs, including private airplanes, of course, and heating huge houses, you know, driving gasoline vehicles, name it.
Yeah.
Their carbon footprints are enormous compared to those of, you know, the average person, let alone compared to the carbon footprints of low-income folks in this country who generally don't consume that much fossil fuel because they don't consume much of anything because they don't have the money. So the money that pays the carbon dividend is going to come disproportionately from the upper income stratum, because they're the ones who use the most carbon. So basically, this is a policy that has a very strong element of redistributing income from the top 1%, or actually even some people not quite as rich as the top 1%, but still in the upper strata of the income pyramid, back to everyone else. And the basis for that is not, you know, pure, you know, distributional envy or something like that. The basis for it is simply fairness, charging for the use of a resource that rightly belongs to us all, which is the right. limited carbon absorptive capacity of the atmosphere. And if they're going to use that much of it, they damn well ought to pay for it.
Exactly.
And the money ought to go to the rightful
exactly.
owners of that resource,
which is us.
Which are you, me, and everyone else.
Now, I have one other question, because as I'm also thinking about this, there still is going to be a different impact. And I'm also looking at the Green New Deal, which was the article that you wrote at the American Prospect.
Sure, yeah.
And that is that should all the dollars from the dividend go directly in a cash response to every single person in the country, or should a portion of it also go to what has happened because of the result of some environmental degradation, because of what you see in poor communities where they really have suffered greater harm because of their location next to a dirty oil plant or in the coal industry? Is there a way of both giving everyone the same, but then also setting aside 20% of the carbon dividend and being able to focus it in a way strategically in places that even though they may see some sort of compensation from the dividend, their amount of harm is overwhelming. And we need to also bring those pockets of environmental injustice up. So I'm just kind of curious, or is it essential for you, in order to keep it pure and simple, we raise a couple of billion, we send out a couple of billion. And I don't want to get into the other tchotchke, because that begins to taint the total belief in the system.
I'm really glad you brought this up, Arnie, because I totally agree that a key part of a progressive climate agenda is to advance the goal of environmental justice, and that means looking out for the well-being of communities that have been historically and systematically really seriously harmed
right.
by the fossil fuel economy. And that those communities include low-income communities, communities of color in urban areas that, as we know, have suffered disproportionate exposure to air pollution of all types, including mm-hmm. pollution from fossil fuels, from power plants, refineries, etc. It also includes rural communities that yeah. have been devastated by mountaintop removal, coal
exactly.
mining, and other practices that have befouled their air and water
exactly.
and left a legacy of toxic contamination. And so I think it's crucial that climate policy that is going to wean us away from fossil fuels, we pay particular attention to the needs of these communities that were damaged by the use of fossil
yes.
fuels, just as we pay special attention to the needs of workers in the oil industry and the gas
right.
industry
right.
and coal miners who have really done a lot of hard, nasty work that other people benefited from, sometimes putting their own health and lives at risk doing that work. They, too, deserve what sometimes is called a just transition,
right.
a transition to a future that doesn't save the planet at their expense, but instead takes care of them and values the contributions they've made to our economy and to our prosperity. And there are certainly ways we can and should do that. It's not rocket science to figure out
how to do it. Among
other things, it involves making sure that we get emissions reductions in the most polluted neighborhoods. It involves just transition assistance for workers in the fossil fuel industry. It involves ecological restoration in communities that have been
So I'm going to go back to my original question. Oh, no, James, I'm going to go back because I only have a minute left. We're talking with James Boyce, senior fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. His new book, obviously, is, of course, The Case for Carbon Dividends, which he's making it so eloquently right now. But what I have to ask you, James, is, but here's my question. You've got the dividend. You now just said a little bit kind of like Andrew Yang, you're going to send everyone the same dividend check no matter what their income is. You see the idea of Social Security and Medicare being sort of your template for this. But Will there be money set aside from the carbon dividend to begin to target those communities? Or are you going to say, we'll find something else for those communities in order to maintain the simplicity, the integrity, and the trust in the carbon dividend? Every dollar raised goes back in the form of a check to everyone. Therefore, there is no diversion of those dollars. Yes, we have to address this, but what we need to do is maintain the integrity of the argument that I'm making, the idea of the case for the carbon dividend, and the idea that if we all benefit the way we all want to protect our air, the way we all want to protect our water, we need to protect this dividend.
Well, I think a good case can be made for funding the public investments that we need to ensure a just transition, not only from carbon revenues, but from other sources as well, including progressive taxation. That said, it's also useful to realize that about 25% of the carbon use in the United States is done by governments, federal, state, and local government, which means that about 25%
of
the money coming in as carbon revenue that would be available for recycling to the public as dividends actually comes from governments.
And on that note, that's
reasonable to me to think that
that money could go back in.
Earmarking a comparable portion of the carbon revenue for public investment is a reasonable idea, and that investment ought to be targeted to the communities and constituencies that need it most.
Thank you.
And there may be a very good case for having other sources of funds for public investment
and
on
that
top
note,
of whatever portion of the carbon revenue
we need to talk. We need to talk with you for an hour. James K. Boyce, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you do it again. There's so much to think about, and I think in a lot of ways the tragedy of the pandemic is also an opportunity for us to focus on things that will not only heal us after the pandemic, but make this a better environment and a better economy. So thank you so much.
You bet, Arnie. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
We'll talk again.
Good luck with the show. I'd be happy to chat again whenever you feel like it.
All right, thank you. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We will see you next week. You better think.